is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I really think it's video. We film at Santa Barbara every practice, obviously every game. We watch constant video, individual video, team video. I think video really reinforces helping kids learn and see it and make corrections.
Sky Etten is beginning his first season as a men's basketball assistant coach at UC Santa Barbara. Sky previously served 6 seasons as an assistant coach at Princeton, where he helped the Tigers to an overall record of 133-69 and a run to the Sweet 16 in 2023. Sky played his collegiate basketball at the College of New Jersey, where he was a 3-year captain, and in his senior season led the Lions to their most wins in a season since 2006. Hey, Hoophead, start the season off strong this October with scary good deals of up to $4,000 off the top training solutions from our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Prepare your team for success this preseason with spooky savings of up to $4,000 off Dr. Dish Basketball's shooting machines designed for schools and programs. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Asim Rastogi from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey coaches, check out our newest sponsor, SportsLab 360, an online platform made up of interactive modules that focus on different tactical concepts, from the basics of reading a screen to specific offenses such as the dribble drive. Especially for our high school coaches out there with such limited practice time with your players, assigning the SportsLab 360 modules to them before practice can save you tons of time from having to stand there and explain these concepts. And you can move more quickly on to the next layer while your competition is still stuck on the fundamentals. As a coach, you can also put customized notes into the players' interactive modules, and you can track how they're scoring on the modules, making it a valuable tool to help identify areas that need development. These guys have had major success in soccer and just recently launched in basketball, and I'd urge all of our listeners to go check them out. Through October and November, you can use the code all lowercase, HOOPHEADS, to save 15% off any SportsLab 360 plan. Head over to www.sportslab360basketball.com to check them out. Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Sky Etten, men's basketball assistant coach at UC Santa Barbara. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Sky Etten, men's basketball assistant coach at UC Santa Barbara. Sky, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, Jason, I appreciate you guys having me, man.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to accomplish thus far in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember from when you were younger.
Yeah, man, I started really early. My parents kind of threw me into the YMCA, and I remember my first day not loving it and my parents making me go back, and second day, I guess I fell in love with it. So, you know, quick hate to, you know, to love moment for me. Just ever since, you know, just kind of grew with the game and made, you know, have made my best friends from the game of basketball, and it's taken me a lot of places. So super fortunate.
Strictly hoops as a kid, or did you play everything?
Yeah, no, I played basketball. I played baseball until I went to the bigger field, and I figured that wasn't for me. And then I played 2 years of football in high school. I wanted to play my whole life, and my parents never let me. And then the football coach convinced my parents junior year to let me play, and it was awesome. So I played basketball and football in high school.
What did your off seasons look like as far as getting better as a basketball player? What did you work on? Were you as organized as a lot of guys are today in terms of putting together a program, or how did you approach getting better as a basketball player when you were a kid?
Yeah, I was organized in my head. I certainly didn't have, you know, all the resources that I feel like these kids have now in terms of, you know, personal strength coach and shooting coach and workout guy. You know, I think now there's so many resources and so many people, you know, helping kids out from the game of basketball that it's a lot easier maybe to get better. But for me, I just went to the park as much as I could. That's, you know, I was always playing. I was always outside. I was always working on my game and trying to improve. And but I definitely think if, you know, nowadays, man, who knows, maybe I've been a little bit better player with all the resources that are out there. But it was really just going to the park and playing.
You would have been a little less creative, though.
Yeah, definitely. definitely.
When you think back to some of those early years as a player before you got to high school, is there a coach that you can think back to during that time that had a big influence on you, somebody that you sort of still think of them or think of the things that they shared with you that are still impacting you today?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think for me in general, the outside my parents, the biggest influence in my life has been coaches. Right. And so, you know, I was lucky enough where my dad coached me all the way up until about seventh, eighth grade. And there was another, I had an AAU coach, Ian Turnbull, who, I played with from about, I don't know, maybe fifth grade to ninth grade, 10th grade. And he was really instrumental. And then I had another coach, Clarence White, who was like a local travel coach that I was always work out with. So, I was really fortunate to have some really good mentors and people, in my life.
When you got to high school, what did you remember as far as just the practices and the camaraderie with your teammates? Do you have a favorite moment that sticks out as a high school player?
Yeah, my high school coach, I started on the freshman team as a freshman, and my high school coach was a coach by the name of Jason Carter, who was a fiery coach and came in with a lot of energy every day and a lot of passion. And we had our ups and downs as a freshman team. And my sophomore year, when I was making the jump to a varsity player, he got the varsity job. And I was like, oh, man, you know, that was it was a hard freshman year with this guy. I don't know how I'm going to make
That's
it.
Fun.
And you know what? It ended up being the best thing for me. And me and him are really close now. And you know, he pushed me out of my comfort zone. And my junior year, we had one of the best years in my high school history where we made it to the sectional championship. And a lot of players on that team I'm still really close with. So that was a great moment for me.
At what point did you start to have a dream that you wanted to play college basketball? And when did it sink into you that, hey, I think I'm legitimately going to have a chance? Was it something that you were always thinking about growing up?
Yeah, you know, I was always thinking about the NBA. I was dreaming big. And then, you know, and then when I think I failed to touch backboard in eighth grade or something along those lines, I realized that wasn't going to be the route for me. But I always knew I wanted to play in college. Like, I loved the game. Like I told you, second day of practice, I fell in love. So I knew I wanted to play in college and, you know, wasn't sure what level I was between, you know, Division II, Division III. I knew I probably wasn't quite Division I, even though I had aspirations of that. And then kind of going into, junior and senior year, realized I was Division III player and, you know, was just trying to find the best opportunity and, you know, got lucky enough to have, you know, to play 4 years in college.
So how do you go about as a player in that position where you start to look around and you say, okay, I think this is where I slot. Did you have somebody kind of helping you through the process, whether it was your parents, your high school coach, AAU coach? How'd you go about getting your name out there so that people could see you and actually recruit you? Because I think that's one of the misconceptions that I see a lot of kids out there, that they maybe aren't proactive in their recruitment. And a lot of times it's not because they wouldn't do it. It's just because they don't necessarily know that that's sort of a really big help to the process. So how'd you go about it?
Yeah, no, I was super fortunate. My mom was so supportive of me. I mean, she sent me to camp. She took me to camps. And she, you know, she even, I think I was, I don't even know what the service was back then, but it was something like NCSA, you know, where they would send emails out to college coaches with game film. And so I think I was on one of those websites. And, you know, my high school coach was also someone that would reach out to people for me and send high school games. And, you know, we had many, you know, between him and my mom and myself, we had a lot of discussions. And, you know, I had them kind of guiding me. And then I, you know, I went to all these, I went to Hoop Group, right? Academic Elite Camp. And there was another one, Mountain Hoops, maybe. I'm forgetting the name, but at Brandeis, I did a couple of those kind of exposure camps, right, where I started to kind of connect with some D3 coaches who were working the camps and get my name out there a little bit. And wasn't heavily recruited, but recruited a little bit. And through that kind of made my way to, you know, my first stop at Guilford and then later the College of New Jersey.
What made the decision initially coming out of school, coming out of high school, to go to Guilford? How did you come to that decision? What was the process of making that choice? Was it the coach? Was it the school? Was it strictly basketball? Was it academics? Was it location? What was important to you coming out of high school?
It was a little bit of everything, right? I had wanted to try to get a little bit of away from Princeton, a place I had lived my whole life. And so Guilford really presented a cool opportunity. They were coming out after two back-to-back Final Fours, right? So they were a really good Division III kind of powerhouse. And, you know, I kind of looked at myself with a Division I mindset, even though I wasn't Division I player, in terms of the love and the commitment for the game. So I wanted to go somewhere that I felt like that was echoed. And when I visited Guilford, it felt like that in every way, right? Just about how they practiced, Coach Palumbo and his staff. And then they also had a really good sports management program, and it was a good academic school. So I thought, you know, coming out of high school, that really fit me well. And so it was a good first place to start for me.
What makes the decision then to go to the College of New Jersey?
Yeah, a couple things. I actually, so the week before, we have an exhibition game against Wake Forest. I break my foot in practice. Ugh. And yeah, man, I was out the whole year, and that was really tough. And you know, I'm away from home for the first time at a pretty small school. And my dad actually was sick at the time. And so I kind of knew early on that I wanted to get back home to be closer to him and my family. And so I thought the College of New Jersey had recruited me out of high school and was a good academic school and about 20 minutes away from home. So I knew right away that's kind of where I wanted to transfer. I did well in school to make sure I could get in, and I only applied there and was lucky enough to get in.
What were you thinking about in terms of a career at this point in college? Did you go in, or did you develop over the course of time an idea of what you thought you wanted to do? Did you always know coaching was where you wanted to be, or were you thinking about something else at this point?
Yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to do, like many, you know, kids that just start college, right? I really was unsure. I knew I wanted to do something in sports. I had a couple different internships. But it's funny, you know, when you have an injury and you're out the whole year, that was the first time in my life that I hadn't played a season, right? My whole life I had played, you know, every game, you know, every season, every year. And this year I was out and I was just watching from the sideline. And that really, you know, you're watching like, wait, I could do this for a living. I could coach and be around the game and be around people for a living. And you know, both my parents are clinical psychologists. So I grew up in a pretty unique household in terms of talking and connecting with people. And so I always knew I wanted to do something working with people. And I wasn't quite as smart as them or wanted to go to as much school as they did. So, you know, I thought this was a good route. And to be honest, like I said earlier, to me, the most influential people outside of my parents have been coaches. And so that year off being injured, getting to watch and see the relationship that the coaches had with the players and what they did really, you know, sparked my interest. And, you know, I started chasing that dream ever since.
Did you get a chance to sort of go behind the scenes with the coaching staff during that year and have conversations that were more coach to coach as opposed to coach to player, if that question makes any sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. I did. You know, I'm sitting there on the sideline with the coaches pretty much, you know, team gets water, coaches are huddling and talking about the next drill, and I'm kind of eavesdropping or just listening, whatever you want to call it, and learning. And you know, after practice, I try to just stay around and pick their brain and just soak up as much as I could. And they were super gracious of letting me kind of be a fly on the wall there. And so I felt like I did start to have a little bit of a different relationship, and it was really cool to see.
All right, so obviously that plants the bug that, hey, maybe coaching is something that I want to get into. When you got back out onto the court, did that cause you in any way to look at or see the game differently once you had that experience of a year of sitting out? Or were you still – coaching was still something that was in the back of your mind and you were still focused on, hey, I'm trying to maximize myself as a player? Just did it change your mindset at all sitting out for that year in terms of how you viewed the game?
Yeah, you know, after I broke my foot, the dream of the NBA definitely went out the window. So, you know, it felt like coaching was the right thing. But no, I think when I got back to playing again, you realize how much you missed it and loved it. And I just, ever since that year, man, I really knew that coaching is what I wanted to at least try to do. I didn't necessarily know it was going to be on the college level. You know, I'd always thought maybe I'll be a school counselor and a high school coach, or I knew I wanted to coach though at some level and some extent. And, you know, I think that was getting back to the game and playing again just validated that even more.
All right. So you graduate, you got to find a job. Clearly coaching is the area that you think you want to go to. You're not even sure what level that you want to be at. Yep. So what is that job hunting process look like? What do you remember about it? What'd you do to try to find that first coaching job?
Yeah. So about, I would say my junior year in college is when the junior summer, I really started to turn the page going into my junior year in terms of like, okay, I'm going to try to do college coaching. How'd I go about it? And I had a family friend, Howard Levy, who was a longtime assistant at Princeton, played at Princeton, now the head coach at Mercer Community College. And I picked his brain and started talking to him. And he's like, well, you should work camps and I'll introduce you. And so he put me in touch with the Princeton staff and I started working camps. And then I started working camps at Rider and Rutgers and kind of just all around a little bit and working as much as I can. I worked a weekend at EYBL. And so that really started to introduce me to people in the business. And then after that summer, I got invited by one of the assistant coaches, Brett McConnell, to do an internship with Princeton, going into my senior year. And so I did it. I did an internship going into my senior year in college and, was doing everything from helping with camps to helping organize recruiting and visit, you know, really anything they asked and learned a ton. And in that moment, I knew definitely that I was going to chase college coaching and was just, I didn't know what level, Division III, Division II, Division I, JUCO, whatever it is. I just wanted an opportunity. And, you know, I was reaching out to a ton of people, sending emails, putting booklets together. You'll appreciate this story. I actually, Maryland had a GA job open and I was like, I would love to be a GA at Maryland, like 100 people would. And Brett McConnell, who's now the associate head coach at Princeton, called the director of ops at Maryland and said, I have this guy, be great, blah, blah, blah. And basically Nima, who was the director of ops at the time, said, hey, we got a lot of people interested. You know, tell them to send me his stuff and we'll think about it. And I drove up to Maryland just to hand it to him face to face. And that got me a conversation and got me in the door a little bit and sure. You know, gave me a chance. So didn't end up doing that. I got lucky to be at Princeton. But, you know, I remember kind of trying to make my ways in.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how you take that little extra step. And obviously in that moment, that didn't pay off in you getting that job. But clearly, I'm sure you made an impression by showing up at the door with your resume in your hand. Makes a big difference when you can do that. And I think it's amazing, Sky, how many people that we've talked to that have gone that extra mile. Because like you said, you have a position that pays next to nothing, and there's 100 applicants for that job. And, you know, there's obviously, I think, amongst a lot of people that aren't in the coaching profession, there's a lot of, I don't know, if misinformation or just people don't understand sort of what it takes to pay your dues and work your way up. And everybody sees the big Division I head coaches and the salaries and all those kinds of things. And people don't realize there's a whole lot of people in coaching, and there aren't a whole lot of those jobs that are available. It takes a long time to be able to get there. So for you, obviously, you get out of school and you get an opportunity to work at an institution like Princeton right out of the gate. I mean, tremendous opportunity for you. What do you remember from that first year? What did you love about just being in the business that first year? What about it just really grabbed you and said, hey, man, this is, I know I'm in the right place. Obviously, as the ops guy, there's some things that you're limited on in terms of what you can do. But just what do you remember about that first year that really turned you on?
Well, I'll tell you what, like starting as an ops guy or video or something along those lines, support staff is the best start to coaching you can get, because you get an opportunity just to listen and learn, right? Like, you're not recruiting, you're not on the floor coaching. You get an opportunity to learn and be the guy behind the scenes, right? And so we had such a good staff that year. And it was, you know, Coach Mitch Henderson, obviously, Brian Earl, who's now the head coach at Cornell, was the associate head coach, Brett McConnell, Donovan Williams. And so we had such a good staff. And for me, you know, I just tried to sit back and learn as much as I could and just listen, right? And it was fascinating. And you know, it grew my love for coaching even more to listen and learn to those guys who are all mentors and you know, influences in my coaching life for sure.
Okay, here's a question that I don't think I've ever asked anybody before, but it's one that has kind of struck me as you were talking, and I'm thinking about that ops position. While the team is practicing and the other members of the staff who are allowed on court to coach, where are you and what are you doing during practice when you can't be on the floor coaching? Are you in the office still breaking down film and doing your daily tasks, whatever those may be? Is that kind of where you are during practice? I would think that it would be difficult to sit in the office knowing, man, right out there, I could be out on the floor coaching. Yeah. Just talk a little bit about that experience, what that's like.
Yeah, I think, you know, each ops role is different in each program. But, you know, Coach Henderson wanted me to be involved as much as I could. Right. And because I had aspirations to coach, I was at every practice. You know, I was kind of running the scoreboard and, you know, encouraging from the sideline and just watching and learning and doing whatever was needed of me. But I was at every practice trying to soak up as much as I could and, you know, get my feet wet a little bit with coaching and really just being, you know, someone that would give high fives and try to pick guys up if they needed it.
When you think about what you learned that first year from an X's and O's practice planning development standpoint, because I think what's always interesting is that, and I say this in regards to my own coaching, when I was a high school player, I played for one head coach. And then when I was in college, I played for one head coach. And so when I got done, I basically, the only experience that I had with coaches was with two guys and what they did, how they organized practice, what they ran, the drills they used. That was pretty much all I was familiar with. And of course, as a 23-year-old kid, I was like, yeah, I know what I'm, you know, I was a good player. I know how to coach. And you realize, looking back, you're like, God, I was terrible. But yeah. Just the opportunity, right, to learn from somebody different who you hadn't played for, you hadn't been around. Talk about how you sort of tried to process what you were learning. Did you have a system for writing stuff down, for keeping track of what you were learning? How'd you go about just internalizing the things that you picked up over the course of that first year or two?
Yeah, no, really good question. It was a process, right? I'm on staff at Princeton, and you're with, you know, some of the best coaches I felt like in the country, and you know, Mitch Henderson, who does a great job, and I think I really do believe this. He's one of the best, you know, of teaching, breaking down, teaching offense, right? In terms of the way he teaches 3-on-3. And, you know, so it, and he thinks so fast. So you're having to pick things up as fast as you can. And, you know, and so for me, I was just trying to, again, listen and learn and pick it up. And so every meeting I brought a notebook and wrote things down. And I would watch the film after practice to try to learn the offense and defense and just making sure that I was up to speed with everything. And, you know, ask questions when the moment was right. You know, but I think a big part of it, to be honest, was taking notes, self-reflection when I went home, watching the film, and really trying to just be engaged in the moment in practice was a huge part of it. And as you know, college practices move really fast. So it was really, really a cool environment to learn, you know, a big part of the game.
What do you remember about the day that you got an opportunity to actually coach on the floor?
It was, I'll tell you what, it was something I won't ever forget. You know, Coach Henderson promoted me. You know, Brian Earle got the head coaching job at Cornell my second year at Princeton. And so Coach Henderson promoted me to an assistant coach on the floor. And you remember, you're nervous and your first day you're stepping on there. I'm like, okay, I'm allowed to step in between the lines now. I don't have to tiptoe around the sideline and baseline. And for me, it was really just trying to be genuine, trying to be myself, trying to be encouraging and teaching what I knew. Right. And still understanding that there was so much more for me to learn and not trying to reinvent the wheel, not trying to do anything different, really do what we did. Right. And you know, but that day was an awesome moment. That year, honestly, was a really fun year. But I definitely remember being nervous and, you know, but being excited at the same time.
What were you good at teaching right out of the gate? What do you feel like was your strength in terms of out on the floor? What could you teach pretty well right from the beginning?
Yeah, I felt like player development, right, working individual with the guys was a strength of mine. You know, I was pretty, you know, obviously I'd just come out of college. I'd just been playing. I could still get out there and move a little bit. And I had the energy and love to do it. And I just felt like my strength was my ability to connect with the players one-on-one and be available to them. Right. Like that's the biggest strength you can have is be available with your time and your energy and your emotion, right? And so I was always one call, one text away from being on the court with the guys, and I think they appreciated that. And so I was fortunate to be able to really do a lot of the player development at my time at Princeton and starting in year one. And so I thought that's really where at first I could add the most value.
How did you guys design what player development looked like for each guy? What was the process for putting together, okay, here's this guy's program, here's what he needs to work on? How did you guys go about designing those player development regimes that you had for each guy?
Yeah, you know, Princeton is known for development, right? It has been for, you know, 50 years, right? Going back to Coach Carrill of like guys improving, guys getting better. What do you see, right? And so Mitch Henderson is of that tree and that family. And so we met and talked about every guy and what they needed to improve on it. And I think the beauty of Princeton is it gives you some ability to be creative and to do some different things. And so we really, you know, Coach was great at not putting anyone in a box. and giving guys freedom to try and do different things. And so for us, we would talk and meet about the individual guys and focus on what they needed to improve on. And then as you got in the season, it was watching the film. What kind of shots do they get? What areas are they struggling? You know, what areas do they really need to improve? Where are they on the court in the offense, and really trying to design during the season the player development based on where they would be in games, right? And so we would try to be really efficient. We would get in 20, 30 minutes during the day and really get in a lot of shots and focus then on what they needed to focus on before practice and be efficient with their time.
So was a lot of the player development when you're talking about working with individual guys, would you do that pre-practice mostly with guys? So you're saying like the 20 minutes leading into practice, you're working with individual players. Is that mostly how you guys were doing it during the season? Out of season, completely different animal, but during the season, is that how you were doing it?
Yeah, it was, you know, Princeton is, you know, you have so many different requirements, obviously academically, that you really had to be flexible. So it was really building a schedule with the guys on what worked best for them. Some guys were morning guys and they wanted to be in the gym at 8 a.m. Some guys wanted to work out after practice. Some guys wanted to work out right before practice. Some guys at lunch. So it was really developing a schedule for each guy based on their class schedule and what fit with them. And then just getting in the gym with them and coordinating with the rest of the staff on what worked. And but we tried to, you know, it's no secret. The best players in the program were the ones that were in the gym the most, right? Like it's no secret anywhere, as you know. So those guys always came around and, you know, would always find time to each day get a workout in.
That's a great answer, Scott. It's hilarious because so the episode that we just recorded before this tonight, we were speaking with Kevin Hopkins, who's the head coach at Muhlenberg Division III school.
Yep.
And
yep.
One of the questions I asked him was, because we were talking a little bit about recruiting, and I asked him, well, when you're trying to recruit, what are the things that you're looking at that you're trying to figure out, okay, is this kid going to be able to have success? And not so much basketball skill, but just when you think about what's going to make a guy successful. And of course, his answer was, you know, it depends, and you know, every guy's different, and sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. And so then I flipped the question. I said, okay, if you could look back at the guys who have been through your program or guys that you've coached when you were at Amherst as an assistant, who are the guys who have had success? And his answer was the exact same answer that you just gave, which again is no surprise to anybody who knows the game. But the fact that I think it speaks to what you just said, which is that's transferable across any level of basketball. You look at it and you say, okay, who are the players who are the best players who ends up having the most success? It's the guys who spend the time in the gym, who are dedicated, who understand what it is that they're supposed to be working on, and they're focused and they're intentional about what they do. I mean, ultimately, those are the guys that I don't care what level you're at. You can talk NBA, you can talk Division I, you can talk Division III, you can talk high school basketball. Yep. The players who are in the gym are the ones who are going to get better. And that's ultimately, I think, right, if you're a coach and you could project in the recruiting process which kids are going to be the ones that are going to put the extra time in, I think if you could let a coach wave a magic wand and say, okay, if I could know one thing about this guy, I think that's the thing that I'd want to know about players. Are they going to be in the gym?
Sure.
And if they're going to be in the gym, then they're going to develop and get to the maximum of their ability, whatever that is.
For sure. I you know, Coach Henderson used to say this all the time is, you know, I've never seen anyone who was always in the gym not improve. Right. Yep. And there's no secret, like you said, at any level, like you put the time in, you put the work in, you're going to get better. So, you know, no, you're absolutely right about that.
All right. So as you're going through your time there with Coach Henderson at Princeton, and obviously tremendous academic institution, so you have that part of it that you're getting a chance to work with kids who not only are great athletes, but they're also great students. You're getting an opportunity to coach on the floor. You start out as an ops guy. You're getting tons of experience. As you think about some of the things that you learned over the course of your time at Princeton, if you could boil that down to one or two things that you learned as an assistant coach that you feel are the most important to being a successful assistant coach, you're giving advice to somebody, hey, here's the two things that you have to do. What are the most important things that an assistant in your mind has to do to really be the kind of assistant coach that any head coach would want to have?
Yeah, I think, you know, assistant is such an interesting role because you get to touch so many different parts of the program, right? And I think the number one thing is, like, you have to support your head coach, right? And you know, it's good to have different ideas. You want to have different ideas. But once you're done meeting, you know, you meet about something, whether it's practice or recruit, whatever the case is, whatever way the head coach says, you got to be aligned in that, right? And I think that is so valuable, is to have a staff that is willing to bring different ideas. But as soon as the decision is made, hey, we're going to go left, you go left, right? And so I think the loyalty to that and the understanding of that the program's got to be aligned and the same message has got to come out on the court. I think that's the number one role for an assistant coach, is to echo the message of the head coach. I think that's so valuable, and I think that's what creates tight-knit groups. And the second part is you got to be, I think, you know, like, for example, when I was ops, there's very clear things that you have to do. Hey, I got to make sure the flights are on time. I got to make sure the bus is on time. I got to make sure the food's here. I got to make sure this. Like, you can make a checklist of things per se, right? Of things that you, tangible things, you know, you have to get done. As an assistant coach, you have to really be thoughtful in that. Like, no one's telling you, you got to make X amount of calls to recruits. No one's telling you, you got to watch this film or how many exact games you got to watch, or, you know what I mean? So I think having that drive and ability to stay organized as an assistant in terms of, okay, hey, today I want to make sure I chop this off my to-do list of, you know, I got to call these recruits. I need to manage how I'm preparing for my next scout. I have to manage the player development, and really organizing yourself in terms of the overall responsibilities you have, I think is so important to be a successful assistant coach, because there's a lot, right? And it can be overwhelming. And if you don't have a clear vision of what you want to get done and how you want to get done, I think you can get lost in that. So I would say those two things, in my experience, are the two most valuable things for assistant coaches, is echoing the message of the head coach and then being organized and thoughtful in your approach to your responsibilities.
Similar to a player, right? Coach,
yeah.
Put the time in and stay organized and have a clear vision of what they want to do. Those are the coaches who end up being successful, because you're putting that time in, you're doing what's necessary in order to, as you said, be able to support your head coach. I think it's really interesting. Obviously, there's a lot of guys that talk about that same thing that you mentioned. Clearly, it's a theme with assistant coaches that you have to be able to be supportive of your head coach, and you want to have those discussions, those disagreements behind closed doors.
For sure.
And then as soon as that door opens up, boom, we're all on the same page. Because if you're not,
for sure,
if one coach on the staff is saying, well, you know, I really, you know, this is what we're doing, but, you know, I'm not really sure that that's, you know, as soon as you start hearing that, things go south. Things go south in a hurry when you get in situations like that, as we all know.
All no right, doubt.
So next thing, let me ask you about recruiting and sort of your approach to recruiting. And obviously we'll talk about UC Santa Barbara, but we also want to talk a little bit about Princeton. But when you think about evaluating a player and you're looking for, is this player going to be a good fit for our program? Where do you start when you're looking at a recruit? What's the first thing that you look at? Is the first thing, obviously, the kid has to have the talent to be able to play there. And then you start getting into things that are maybe more subjective. Does this guy fit what my head coach is looking for? Is he a positional need, intangibles? Just what's the process that you look for as you start to narrow down trying to find the right guy for your institution?
Yeah, I think first, you know, the two places I've been, Princeton and now UC Santa Barbara, obviously are both really good academic schools. So the first thing is making sure they can get in, right? So that's looking at transcripts, gathering transcripts, and really trying to understand their academic profile. And then the next thing is understanding the culture, the need, and the style of play, right? Like, each team is different. And so that, you know, contributes to how you recruit. Like, certain, you know, at Princeton, we really valued skill and IQ, And so you had to look for that. Like, you had to have that to be able to play for us. Here at Santa Barbara, we're similar, and we really do value shooting. But we also value athleticism and toughness. And so I think, you know, each program is a little bit different. So you have to really know what your boss is looking for. You have to know what your roster needs. You have to really be mindful and thoughtful in that process.
Do you have a preference of watching a kid in their AAU environment versus their high school environment? Does it matter? Are you looking for the same things, different things? How do you evaluate a kid AAU versus high school, what you see?
Yeah, I'd be honest. I like to see him in both places because I think it shows something different, right? Obviously, in AAU, most of the time, there's more talent on the court together, right? You're playing against more talent. Your team has more talent. You're going to have a little bit of a different role. High school, you might be the guy, right? You might not have as much talent on your team. You might not be going against as much talent, but you have a different role. And I want to see you in both roles and how you contribute and find value in both those roles. So I really like the evaluating process is seeing him in both, because I think it gives you a holistic, view of that prospect.
How do you define, you talked about it earlier, basketball IQ? Everybody kind of has a different idea in their mind of what that means. When you say basketball IQ, what are you looking for? What does that look like to you when a player has a high basketball IQ?
I think, basketball IQ and sometimes passing are very similar, but also a little bit different, right? I think passing is a big part of IQ in a sense of being able to see the floor, being able to understand, make the right play in the right moment, understanding the time and the game and the situation. But also it's defensive IQ, understanding how to communicate on the court, understanding where you should be on the court in help side defense, how you should guard your man, what's your, the guy you're guarding, is he, someone that makes a lot of shots? Has he just made three threes? Is he someone that's getting to the rim? Like, understanding those moments, I think, encompasses all of basketball IQ. So it's really watching the kid and seeing if they see those things, right? And they're trying to actively do those things and be consistent in those things, I think, is a big part of IQ. But it's a lot of making the right plays, trying to make the right plays. You don't always make them, but is the kid trying to make the right plays? I try to watch really closely and see what they see when they don't have the ball in their hands. Are they moving? Are they spaced? Are they cutting? Or are they just standing? Are they lost? Right. And so, I think IQ tells you a lot about how the kid, will impact the game when he doesn't have the ball in his hands.
How do you develop that in a player as a coach? If you're trying to help your team and your individual players develop their IQ, obviously in a player development setting, you're working on their individual basketball skills, but how do you work on a player's basketball IQ? What's some thoughts you have there?
I think that's the million-dollar question. It may be the hardest thing to do, right? Like, I really do think some of that is innate, right? I think it's proven, hey, you can help a kid improve shooting. Hey, you can help a kid improve around the rim and finishing. Hey, you can help a kid understand, maybe some things on defense. But I really do think sometimes basketball IQ is hard to teach. But the best way to do it is through experience, is through video, right? Is through constant coaching. Like, I do think that the coaching aspect is, and where we come in the most, is helping kids understand the game and understand, especially at the college level, understand coverages and understand, how you play help side, how you play, how you talk to a teammate, how you talk on defense, the communication, the language. I think that's a big role that we play in their development and understanding spacing and timing on offense. So I really think it's video. We film at Santa Barbara every practice, obviously every game. We watch constant video, individual video, team video. So I think video really reinforces, helping kids learn and see it and make corrections.
When you're looking at video with your guys, how do you balance out showing them things that they've done well and that they're doing correctly that you want them to repeat versus things that they've done incorrectly that you want to see them fixed? Are you intentional about thinking about the balance between showing the positive and showing the negative, and then how do you approach each one of those?
Definitely. I think it's so important to also show, you can't just show all negative, all corrections, right? Like at some point, I think the kid then tunes out and gets discouraged. And it's a huge part. You show positives, like kids learning, like, oh, wait, I need to do more of that. Like I just sprinted the floor really hard and look what happened. I got a wide open layup, or look what happened. I got a teammate open, right? And so I think you got to, in video, be encouraging. So for me, it's, you know, I try to show the positive things, and then I really try to focus on what I think they really need to improve in that day, right? I don't try to hit them with everything they did wrong in a practice or every maybe mistake they made. I really try to focus on the big themes of, hey, where I think they can improve. Hey, you know, here you weren't understanding that, you know, you had to be in this position defensively. Like you were never getting in the gaps. You weren't in the help. This is how you move into the gaps. You know, whatever the case may be, I try to focus on a big theme and show that and be less about mistakes and be more about, hey, this is where, once you understand this, look how much better you're going to be in these moments, right? And include, obviously, the positive stuff in that as well.
When do you guys use film? Are you going to be using it before practice? Like if you're going to have an individual meeting with the player, is that something that you're doing right before practice? Is that something where they're coming in between classes to spend 10 or 15 minutes going through the film, just from an individual standpoint? Then we could talk about the team standpoint, but individually, when do you meet with guys to go over their film on a one-on-one basis?
Yeah, I try to grab them, you know, throughout the day. You know, maybe if they're going to come in for a skills workout at 10 or whatever the case may be based on their class schedule, you know, I'll have them come in 15 minutes earlier so that I can show them, you know, 10 to 12 clips of things they need to see, and then we'll get on the court. So I try to grab them before practice so that then they can incorporate those things into the next practice as best I can.
All right. And then from a team standpoint, are you guys watching film as a team before practice? What did it look like at Princeton, and what do you think it's going to look like at Santa Barbara?
Yeah, I think similar in regards. At Princeton, we showed, you know, we would show 15 minutes, 20 minutes, depending on the day, before every practice, right? Of every practice, or when you get in the season of games. And I think we're similar here at Santa Barbara, where we're going to show team film right before practice, 15 minutes, you know, big themes of where we need to really focus on for the upcoming practice. So it's the full team together right before practice, right before you get out there, is when, in both, you know, at Princeton and here now at Santa Barbara, where we'll show film.
When you started at Princeton, were you guys filming practices from day one when you first got there?
Yeah, we were. We were. It changed over my time. It went from, you know, a manager to some had to do it when I was ops to now, you know, having a fully automated video system, right, which makes everyone life a little bit better, right? So it changed, but we did film every practice.
Being able to film practice, I have to imagine, just is such a valuable tool when it comes to being able to teach your individual players, and also from a team standpoint, being able to go back and look and evaluate as a coaching staff, thinking about, is what we think we saw, is that what we actually saw? So tell me a little bit about what you, as a coaching staff, when you're watching the practice together, what are some of the key things that you're trying to zero in on? If there's anything that sort of is an overriding theme, obviously day to day, you might be looking for different things, but just in general, what are some of the things that you look for in a practice film?
Yeah, I mean, the film is so good. You know, they have the saying, third eye in the sky doesn't lie, right? And you know, I think that's so true for players, but also coaches. Like you're in a game or you're in practice and you think, you know, this action hurt you, or you didn't do this well, and you really watch the film and you realize, well, we actually did do this well, or this didn't hurt us as much as you think. And so I think it's really, when you watch the film, you really try to refocus on where you need to improve, right? What were the key things that maybe you didn't realize during practice that you need to clean up? Or maybe you did realize, right? And you need to show these specific things to the guys. You have such an advantage by, you know, being able to replay and rewatch game film and practice film. So I think it's just, it's trying to be really detailed in your approach and be really clear, right? You know, as coaches, you watch so much film, but you have to do a great job of managing what you tell your players, because at some point it becomes information overload.
Right.
So I think Coach Pasternak at Santa Barbara, you know, he does a really good job in being really concise and really direct in our film work and not overloading the guys.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder Vlad Moldovaniu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial. Talk about film work from an assistant coach's standpoint when you're scouting. A, obviously you're trying to help your team win a particular game, but not only that, that's got to be like just being in a basketball classroom day in and day out when you're studying opponents and getting a look at what they do and how they're successful and what works for them and what actions do they defend well. And you're watching so many different opponents that you're getting a master class in basically X's and O's. So talk about how valuable that's been for you and your career to be responsible for the scouting and then how you've incorporated that into your knowledge of the game.
It's so good. I mean, you know, at this level, every coach that's made it to this level is a really good coach and runs really good stuff. And so, by doing scouts, you're watching, you know, depending on who the opponent is and you know, if it's conference or non-conference, you're watching a lot of other teams' games, right? And you're seeing the progression of how they've progressed throughout the year and what they're doing. And you take things from them that you add to, you know, your team or how you coach or how you see the game. So to be honest, like I was similar to you in terms of I had one high school coach, I had one college coach. And so I think, you know, I just knew what I knew. Right. And so, you know, all of a sudden you jump into college basketball and then you're responsible for scouts and you're watching all these different opponents. And there's a whole nother side of how teams play offensively and defensively that, you know, maybe you didn't realize and you have to kind of learn on the fly. And so it's been so good for me, to learn from other teams and to watch film and to dive into that. And, it's really been a lot of fun and you're right. It's every day. It's like a class you're watching, and you're taking notes, and you're learning, on, you know, how to execute against really good teams and really good coaches.
Last year, you guys had a magical run NCAA tournament, 15 seed. You guys beat a 2, beat Arizona, and then you go and beat Missouri. What, just tell me a little bit about what that experience was like for you guys as a coaching staff, for your players, and just how special that experience was and how that, I'm sure, just created bonds that team is going to be probably connected for the rest of their lives, even deeper than any other team, just because of the special nature of what you guys accomplished last year.
Yeah, it's cliche, but it's really hard to put into words. Like it was such a special year in so many ways. I mean, you know, I think what people don't realize, Mike, is that team had gone through a lot of adversity in a sense of they had a year where they didn't play because of COVID, right? The Ivy League was the only league in the country that didn't play for a whole entire year. And so the team had went through, you know, the sophomores that then on that team were seniors didn't get a sophomore year, right? And so they had been through adversity. And then the following year, we won the regular season but lost in the conference championship. Or the previous year, excuse me. So that team had been through some adversity that I think tied the group together. And then, you know, what they were able to accomplish together as a unit is something that none of us will ever forget. I mean, me personally, you know, just being in that moment and in that stage and being able to do something, I think not only for our program, but for alumni, for fans, for people that have supported us through so many ways, families, is something that you'll never forget and you'll always be tied to. And, you know, I think that team is going to be coming back for reunions, you know, for a long, long time at Princeton because of what they did and how special of a group. So it's going to be a lot of fun to reminisce with those guys, you know, for the rest of life. You know, I'm so lucky to have been a part of it.
All right. Without giving away your secrets, going into that game as a 15 seed, and you're breaking down the film and you're looking at Arizona and you're looking at your team, are you finding things that when you're looking at it, you're going, okay, I think we could maybe do this, or here's a spot where we can attack? How, and again, I don't know if confident is the right word, but did you feel like if things went in your favor that there was this real solid opportunity? Because, I mean, come on. Let's face it, there are times when you go into a game where we've all been in those games, and I'm not saying that at Princeton it happened very often, but there have been games and places where you've gone in and you're like, unless this thing goes absolutely perfectly, we don't feel like we have a realistic shot to win. So did you guys going into that as you're scouting Arizona, you're looking at it, did you feel like there were things that, hey, if we can exploit this or if we can control that, that there was a pathway? Did you guys see the pathway to winning that game realistically? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, I'll even back it up a second. So, you know, the Ivy League is the last, pretty much the last conference tournament to play. You know, our championship game is on Selection Sunday at, you know, noon or something along those lines. And Selection Sunday is at 6 p.m. And, you know, so we beat Yale in the championship. And when you win our league, which is so competitive, you know, that's the goal, is to win the league. You put all the chips in winning the league every year here at Princeton, you know, at Princeton. And so, you know, at that point, when we get to the selection show, you know, at least in my head, I was like, I'll play anyone. I don't care who we're playing. I'll play, you know, the Lakers. It doesn't matter at this point. And then all of a sudden you hear your name called against Arizona and the Monstars. And you're like, okay, what are we going to do now? And reality kind of checks in quickly. And you know, you realize, you know, you knew how good they were from, you know, just their reputation and, you know, having catch a couple of their games. And, you know, as we all started to watch film, I think it was, you know, we had a older group, right, where they had a really mature approach about them and they were really confident, right? They knew that they deserve to be in the NCAA tournament, and they knew they deserved to have a chance to advance in it. So I think as we started to break down film, we knew there were certain things that we had to do really well to be able to have that chance, right? And if we did those things well, and if we just were able to stay in the game, then anything can happen in March, right? And that is really, you know, true. And you know, as history would point out, right? And so I think just watching the film, the biggest things were locking in on what we had to do. Like, we had to sprint back on defense because they were elite in transition, right? We had to do a great job on the glass because they were ginormous, right? We had to take care of the ball. And we felt as if we did those things, we were a hard matchup for teams as well to prepare for, you know, our offense. And so if we did those things well, we had a chance against anyone. But the seeing Arizona, it definitely felt at first like we were playing the Monstars.
All right. So you come off that run, and I'm assuming that you start looking and thinking about your career and where you are and what you want to do and what you want to accomplish. And so obviously that's a magical run in the tournament last year. And you start looking at your career. You've been at Princeton for 8 years since you graduated from college. And clearly that's a time where, man, you just had this run in the NCAA tournament. What's the thought process of going to UC Santa Barbara? How do you get out there? What's the connection? How's that job come across your desk? What's the thought process in taking the job, and what made the opportunity the right one for you at the right time?
Yeah, I think the last part, it was the right opportunity at the right time. I loved Princeton, you know, every moment. I learned so much and consider Coach Henderson a mentor of mine. And so it was a really hard decision, Mike. And I think, you know, for me, the ultimate goal was to be a Division I head coach. That's the ultimate goal. So after the season, you always kind of reevaluate, like, are you on that path, right? Are you doing the right things to hopefully put yourself in that position? And I had been at Princeton recruiting a lot of the West Coast, and so had started to build some connections out on the West Coast. And, you know, we had been fortunate to have some success in getting a couple good players. And so I just, you know, through recruiting, I got to know Coach Pasternak at UC Santa Barbara, who's done a great job here. And so, you know, got to build a relationship with him throughout the years. And you know, he recruited some of our grad transfers at Princeton and in the Ivy League. So, you know, we would talk throughout the year, you know, about guys and I'd give him my input on that. And, you know, he had a spot come open. And, you know, to be honest, I wasn't necessarily looking because of, you know, how happy I was at Princeton. But when Coach gave me a call and told me he had a spot, it was something that I, you know, had to really think and ultimately evaluate that it was the best decision I thought. For my career, to do something different, to do something new, right? And when you're in the Ivy League, it's such a unique, you know, obviously you're dealing without scholarships and, you know, you're not dealing with the transfer portal because no one leaves Ivy League schools, right? And so I felt like in terms of my overall growth that this was, you know, the next step for me to learn to do something a little bit different, right? Learn from a different head coach and put myself in, you know, maybe a little bit of an uncomfortable situation, right? Because I had, you know, been in such a good spot for so long. So I just felt the timing made sense for me. But I am so appreciative and so fortunate to have learned from Coach Henderson and Brett McConnell and Brian Earle and all those guys that were on staff in my time. Those will always be great memories and a family. And, you know, I'm excited for this next journey here.
What's been the best part of it so far?
I'll tell you what, man, Santa Barbara, you know, everyone's, you know, been asking, hey, how's the adjustment been? And, you know, my answer is, well, if you were living in Santa Barbara, you'd understand it's not bad. it's, you know, Santa Barbara's truly amazing. It's, you know, campus is right on the beach. It's a beautiful area to be in. And we're really fortunate here in terms of a basketball program that, you know, Coach Pasternak has built this into, you know, a big time program. And so, you know, the way we operate and do some things, I think, are really exciting and we have a really good group. So I'm excited.
I always say I've visited San Diego like 4 times in my life, and I always say I'd love to live in San Diego, but I honestly don't know if I could ever go to work in San Diego.
Yeah.
When every day it's 75 degrees and sunny, I think I'd have a hard time keeping a job.
It's amazing. My compromise is I try to walk to work as much as I can to get out, man. But no, it's
there. You go.
It's amazing.
I love it. All right. So biggest difference between the two schools, and you can take that in whatever direction you want. You could take that basketball, school, geography, just what's been, I guess, your biggest adjustment, the biggest difference between the two jobs. Obviously, you know the Princeton job a lot better because you were there for a lot longer and you're still getting into the Santa Barbara job, but just what's been the biggest difference between the two so far?
Yeah, there's quite a few differences. I think one is, I'll first start with a similarity in terms of I wanted to stay in the academic realm and Santa Barbara is a really good school. Obviously, Princeton's number one school in the country, but Santa Barbara is a top 25 school in the country. So I think I didn't stray far away from that, which was really good. And then, you know, I think in terms of philosophies, it's a little bit different from a coaching perspective. I'm fortunate enough where Coach Henderson is a disciple of Coach Carrillo, one of the best coaches of all time, right? And Coach Pasternak is a disciple of Bobby Knight, one of the best coaches of all time, right? So I'm learning two different ways from people that have been among the best coaches in our game. I think, you know, the way we play is a little bit different. No better, no worse, but, you know, just a little bit different here. And then just the overall, like at Princeton and in the Ivy League, you're recruiting a class of 5 high school kids per year, pretty much, right? You don't take transfers. You can't get transfers in. And so you're really recruiting high school kids here at Santa Barbara. We're recruiting high school kids, but we're also have some really good transfers on our roster, right? And so that's totally different. Just the mindset of how you organize a roster. It's a little bit more tricky, right? It's pretty cut and dry at Princeton. Hey, you're losing 4 seniors. You're going to bring in 4 freshmen.
Right. You know,
let's manage the roster. Let's build the roster this way. Obviously, you're working with scholarships and a couple other luxuries that, you know, we might not have had at Princeton. So just different, right, in terms of how you build a roster and how you look at a roster, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes a ton of sense. All right, let's wrap this up with a 2-part question. I think it fits directly here with the timeline. Part one, when you think ahead, you're in a new position all the way across the country. What's the biggest challenge that you have ahead of you in the next year or two? And then number two, when you think about what you get to do every day, talk about what brings you the most joy about coaching college basketball. So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Yeah, I think that the biggest challenge anytime, like anywhere you start a new job, it's figuring out where you can add the most value, right? And we have a really good staff here at UC Santa Barbara. And obviously Coach Pasternak has done an unbelievable job here. So I think the biggest challenge is continuing to figure out where, you know, I can help the most, right? And add the most value and, you know, whether that's to the guys on the court or whether that's to, you know, the recruiting aspect or the team aspect and just trying to, play my part, right? And continue to build on, the success, that coach has had here. So I think that's always a challenge, you know, is, you know, for me, at least I try not to assume or go into anything, with a predetermined mindset. I really try to evaluate, think thoughtfully and figure out where, I can help the most and support coach the most. So I think, you know, continuing to learn each and every day, where those, you know, values are, is probably, continuous challenge in a good way. And then, you know, for me, it's the guys, it's the relationship with the guys. It always has been. It always will be for me in terms of what gets me excited. It's like, you know, how lucky am I that I get to, you know, wake up every day and be around the game of basketball with these young guys that keep me young and, you know, it's, you know, just the relationships you get to build on and off the court. You know, the guys I coached at Princeton, I consider family. I still talk to guys I graduate. I still talk to the current team a ton. And I don't think that will be any different here at UC Santa Barbara with the guys that we have on our roster and you know, really building that relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. All right. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, find out more about the program at Santa Barbara. Share website, email, social media, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I will jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, no, you can follow me on Twitter at Skylar Etten. I try to post as much as I can about Santa Barbara and obviously on our website at UC Santa Barbara. You can obviously follow the team and our Twitter handle, UC Santa Barbara men's basketball. So, Mike, I appreciate you having me, man. I really enjoyed the conversation and I've enjoyed being a listener and a fan for a while. So I appreciate you inviting me to be a part of it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight. It's been a lot of fun. It's always nice to hear kind words from somebody who's actually out there listening. Like I always say, we know people are listening because we can see the metrics, but it's always nice to hear an actual voice tell us, hey, we listen and we find value in it. So again, we are thrilled to be able to have you on. And again, it's an exciting time for you and your career to be able to go from one great program in Princeton on one side of the country and go all the way across to the opposite coast and to be able to kind of get a fresh start at Santa Barbara. And again, we wish you nothing but the best in your quest to help Santa Barbara have a successful season and eventually to reach your goal of becoming a Division I head coach. So again, thank you. Truly appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.